Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. Summer and sports go together, so do sports and injuries. How do we keep our young athletes safe? We'll be talking about that just a little bit later. But first, when Angelina Jolie announced that she had undergone a double mastectomy as a preventive measure because of a genetic predisposition to breast cancer, she inspired an emotional dialogue. Was it helpful to women, or might it encourage some to seek unnecessary surgery? We'll talk about that today with Joanne Kelly, an oncology nurse at St. Louis University Hospital. She underwent a preventive double mastectomy and hysterectomy because of her genetic cancer risk. Her counselor is Dr. Suzanne Mahon, a genetics expert who directs the St. Louis University Cancer Center's Heredity Cancer Screening Program. Ladies, thanks so much for being with us. Nice to have you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Suzanne, I'd like to begin with you, and I'll have the same question for you, Joanne, in just a moment. Should Angelina Jolie have gone public?
I think she's done a gigantic service for the public. She has made this acceptable for people to stop and think about their risk and to talk to other people about it. And the first step in this whole process is to understand your risk. So I think it's been a huge service to the public.
How about you?
I agree. I think it was a good thing for her to come out. I think she's obviously well known. She's popular. And she can certainly make a difference for people who have family history, or at least to start the discussion of should I be tested or not. I have a family history.
But there was some discussion early on when she did come out, some concern that perhaps it would trigger a number of women to seek unnecessary surgery, perhaps. Suzanne, do you buy that?
I think certainly the number of calls I have received for people wanting to explore testing has quadrupled in the last week. So I'm certainly feeling that busyness myself. But I think what women need to understand is that they don't just jump to that big surgical decision. They absolutely should be seen by a credentialed counselor who is going to help them, guide them through that decision. A lot of the patients I see never get to testing because we can manage them other ways and testing is not going to be helpful or provide any useful information. So I don't think it's such a problem if people are going to take the steps to be counseled correctly.
And Joanne, tell us if you would, if you don't mind, tell us about your decision and what you went through, what the process was like for you.
My decision goes back to probably 2000, where I saw a breast surgeon for a mass that I had had. It was non-cancerous. It was just a fatty tissue called a lipoma. And going over family history, that breast surgeon said, wow, you really need to see a genetic counselor. And when I saw a genetic counselor at that time, the option of genetic testing was really not given to me. Other things were talked about, but I was probably too young to even grasp that, even though I knew my family history was very serious. And then I, you know, started working with oncology patients as a nurse and really, you know, discovered my own mortality, I guess you could say, had children, and then realized that I have a really extensive family history. And this clearly is something more than just a few people in my family having cancer. So I then started working at SLU back in 2008. And my colleague, my coworker, Michelle, actually said, hey, I want you to meet somebody. And she introduced me to Dr. Mahon. And that's how the process got started for me with getting tested.
So your decision was based primarily on family history as opposed to a specific gene, such as the BRCA genes, I guess they're called. Is that right, Suzanne?
Right.
Yeah.
But when she came, we tested another family member first who actually had breast cancer, so we could determine that the family carried that gene. It's always best when we can to test someone who has the cancer. We have a much better chance of finding it, and then we can kind of clarify that risk in the family. Once we know that someone in the family carries the gene, then we can test other family members for that single site at a lot less money, and it's a lot more informative. So it's a series of steps. So sometimes the first person I see is not necessarily the best person to see, and we go back and look and see who can really provide us with the most useful information.
The expense is something that I wanted to get to at some point because it is significant.
It can be close to $4,000 to test the first person. And if they are appropriate in terms of they have a diagnosis of breast or ovarian cancer or they have a significantly high risk, insurance companies will frequently pay for it. Medicare has very specific criteria for who they will pay for and who they will not pay for. Once you establish that the family carries a mutation through that extensive testing, comprehensive testing, then we can do single site testing, which still is expensive. It's approximately $475, but it's a lot less expensive. Insurance companies will frequently pay for that as well because it's not a fishing expedition. We know what we're looking for.
Do we have any sense, or do you have any sense as to whether the Affordable Care Act, so-called Obamacare, is going to have any influence on this sort of thing?
Theoretically, it should, because this is a preventative health maintenance service. The issue is that it is not for everybody. Only about 10% of people with a diagnosis of breast or ovarian cancer probably really have true hereditary risk. So just because you have a diagnosis of breast cancer doesn't mean you should automatically do it. It's still, we look at the family history, size and diagnosis, the number of diagnoses, the mother's side, the father's side. So it's not going to still be a one-size-fits-all. There still will be criteria and things we think about before we offer testing.
You had said before we went on the air that you are very, very grateful to Joanne because she has gone public with this. Explain why you need to be grateful to her.
For many years, people would say, oh, I'd like to interview one of your patients, and most of my patients did not want to share that. I think it's very difficult. These are courageous, brave women who do not have a diagnosis of cancer, and they are faced with very complicated decisions. If you have a diagnosis of cancer, you have to jump up and do whatever we tell you as quick as we tell you. Whereas these people, once they test positive, they know they have risk. They know that the risk is high. It's like 90% for breast cancer, close to 50% for ovarian cancer. But they don't know when it's going to happen, exactly where it's going to happen. So they trade one kind of unknown for another. And I think a lot of people just really don't understand how scary that is, and they don't know how to approach them. So I am forever grateful to Joanne for all she's done to promote awareness about this in the St. Louis community.
And we had also talked, Joanne, mm-hmm. about the difficulty women have had typically and traditionally about talking about this.
Right.
I thought your answer off the air was so good we ought to put it on the air.
Well, it's a very private issue, and it's a kind of behind-the-doors kind of issue, and nobody really wants to talk about removing body parts that are private. So it is a difficult decision, and I think it's uncomfortable for a lot of people to talk about that particular body part also. And to remove healthy breasts, people look at you like you're crazy. Mm-hmm. Most people around me supported my decision, but there are some out there who think it's ridiculous. And I think that we see a lot of that online recently now that Angelina has come out. There's been a lot of rather negative articles that have come out and some pretty really awful comments that have been made about people who do make this choice. And so it can be very difficult. And I think the important thing to get out is, like Dr. Mahon said, it's not for everyone. And to have at least a discussion with a genetic counselor is very, very important to start. You can't just run out and get tested. You have to know what are you going to do with that information if you are positive or negative, really.
Once you had that information, how long did it take you to make the ultimate decision?
I knew going into the day that I got my results that I would choose prophylactic surgery if I was positive. I had thought long and hard about it for a few years, actually. And so I knew that if I were positive, I would have surgery. So I knew going into that. But still, sitting at the table and having those big capital letters that say positive for mutation was still very difficult, even though I'd kind of worked myself up to knowing that, assuming that I did have the mutation.
How much support did you have?
Tons.
In terms of
everyone at my work, the physicians I work with, the nurses, especially my colleague Michelle that I mentioned earlier, mm-hmm. my family, my husband is my biggest fan, mm-hmm. and my mother, of course, she's the only living person in my family who's had cancer, who also, of course, carries this mutation. So tons of family support and coworkers as well.
The mutation, are we talking about the same mutation that Angelina Jolie?
Yeah, I believe she's BRCA1 positive. I'm also BRCA1 positive. Oh. There are some that have the BRCA2 mutation.
And that's the one, that's the mutation that really is
the one that's concerned. Clinically, they're almost the same. Mm-hmm. You know, if someone has one, they're generally their risk for breast cancer is about 90%. If they've already had breast cancer, their chance of a second breast cancer is about 65%, mm-hmm. and their chance of ovarian cancer is about 50%. They are very, very similar, we don't really make a big difference between the two.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You've said, Suzanne, that this step is not for everyone. Who is it for and who is it not for?
One of the things that we spend a lot of time, genetic education and counseling is really about trying to figure out how you're going to respond to this. So, you know, things I talk to people about are if you test positive, what are you willing to do? What do you hope to get out of this? And if they say, I'm not going to ever have any preventative surgery or anything, then probably they should never test because I can manage them with, you know, sending them for regular screening and whatnot. They can't prevent the cancer, but hopefully they would find it early. So if they're not motivated to do anything differently, that is probably one of the biggest reasons to not test.
The biggest motivation, it would seem to me, would be to continue living.
It gives people control. We can truly prevent cancer. When you do a prophylactic mastectomy, you're reducing that risk to probably, you know, down to 1% or 2% if it's done correctly, and taking out the ovaries between the ages of 35 and 45, you probably take that risk way down to about 3, 4, 5%. So it absolutely works, and it gives people control. They choose when they do it and how they do it. If they say, you know, I'm positive, but 3 months from now would be a good time for me to have that surgery, that's fine. They control that, not us. And I think the idea that you can actually prevent it and not be worried about it down the line is the biggest reason that people eventually do it.
Well, I have to take a break now. We'll continue the conversation in just a moment, and certainly we'd be willing to listen to some of our listeners and what they think about this issue. Was Angelina Jolie correct in making the decision she did? My guests in studio are Joanne Kelly, an oncology nurse at St. Louis University Hospital. She underwent preventive surgery because of her genetic cancer risk. Also with me in studio is Suzanne Mahan, a genetics expert who directs the St. Louis University Cancer Center's Heredity Cancer Screening Program. Back in just a moment. Our numbers, by the way, don't want to forget those, 382-8255. That's 382-TALK. Send us an email at talk@stlpublicradio.org. We'll take a tweet at STL on air. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again, and welcome back to our conversation with Joanne Kelly and Suzanne Mahan. We are talking about preventive surgery. If someone has a genetic predisposition to cancer, it has received so much attention recently because of Angelina Jolie's coming out, if you will, in the New York Times with an op-ed piece saying that she, in fact, had a double mastectomy. And Joanne Kelly here has gone through the same process and also had a hysterectomy, mm-hmm. as part of all of this. You know, going back to the reasons for doing, and of course the ultimate reason is to survive and lengthen one's life. But I was struck because it was so touching that Mrs. Jolie pointed out that she wanted to see her kids reach those stages in life that all parents.
Absolutely.
How much of a role did that play with you?
Probably 90% of my decision was geared for my children. You know, I've seen the effects of breast cancer, and I've seen a lot of deaths from various cancers, and I didn't want my children to see me go through that. Mm-hmm. And I want to see them grow up, graduate, have children of their own, and for me to be healthy when that process and to just try to live a normal life as much as I can.
How did you or have you explained all of this to them?
Very open with my children. When I had my mastectomy in 2008, so it's been almost 5 years. And my oldest son, Zach, was 10, and my youngest son, Owen, was 3. So he didn't quite understand, but I was very open with them, showed them my dressings, you know, just to see, hey, mommy's okay. I have, you know, my youngest called it a boo-boo. for a long time, but very open and honest with them, and to show them this is what happened to me, but I'm okay, and I'm going to be okay because of doing this. Mm-hmm. So very honest with them. I don't know that they really fully grasp it, of course, but you have to be honest with your kids. They know stuff is going on even if you try to hide it. So very, very honest with them and encourage them to ask questions.
And Suzanne, I'm sure that this is part of what you do, is encouraging this kind of honesty.
Right, and we do. We talk to patients about how to manage it. She had young boys. It's a totally different experience for the mother who has three teenage daughters, you know. So we don't – it's not a one-size-fits-all. Each patient, we kind of look at their individual situation, and we try to help them understand how they can manage it and give them that guidance.
And if the patient has daughters, this, as you say, one size does not fit all, but this puts a special emphasis on this whole discussion.
Right. The offspring of someone who has the mutation, each offspring, each individual has a 50% chance of having it and a 50% chance of not having it. Obviously, it's probably more emotionally laden for the daughters than for the sons. We generally test young people for this mutation when they reach their mid-20s, unless there's some extenuating reason to test earlier in the family. So when this happens, we don't, you know, if a woman has a 13 or 14-year-old, they all say, oh, I want to get my daughter tested. And that's not the time. Those children need to mature and understand the decisions that they're making.
Is there a best time, a best age? You mentioned the early 20s, but what if someone has learned at age 50?
Absolutely. I test women in their 60s and 70s. This morning I saw a very vibrant 70-year-old woman who is willing to undergo having her ovaries removed. She's already had one mastectomy, and she is willing to consider that the other side. There's no reason to think that this woman wouldn't live 15, 20 more years, and there's a known mutation in the family. So, I mean, there's not necessarily the biggest driving factor is, are you going to be willing to do something about it? And if they're willing to do something, then that's appropriate. That's really why we don't test 13 and 14-year-olds, because you're not going to do anything about it at that age.
Sure. Let's take a couple of phone calls. We have some people who want to get into the discussion, so let's bring in Carol first, calling from St. Louis. Carol, thanks for being with us. Go ahead.
Thank you for taking the call. So I have a strong family history, had the genetic testing done, and I'm in my 60s. Just had it done a few months ago. I am not a carrier. But so I'm looking at the other side of the coin. Does this absolutely leave my daughter in the clear as long as there's nothing, no contributing factors from her father's side of the family, or does it ever skip a generation? Does she need to be tested anyway when she reaches that age?
It can't skip a generation. If you don't carry the BRCA1 or 2, she will not carry the BRCA1 or 2. But a negative test is sometimes non-informative because you could still have some other odd hereditary risk for which testing is not available or is not as likely to be done. So one of the biggest things I do when I counsel patients who test negative, such as yourself, is we give them specific recommendations for care, and those recommendations might be much different than the basic American Cancer Society guidelines. And so your daughters may benefit from, and you as well may benefit from, having recommendations for screening modified. The other thing I always tell families is that genetic testing changes, and they are to check back with us every 18 months to see if there's new testing available that might help clarify their risk. So a negative test does not mean that there's not hereditary risk by any means.
Oh, wow. All right, good information.
Carol, thank you so much for the call. Let's bring in Jennifer, calling from St. Louis. Jennifer, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, thank you for having me, and thank you for covering what I consider to be a really important topic. My both my mother and my sister died in their 30s from breast cancer, and so I elected in 2005, and I used the term elected loosely because I really didn't feel like I had a choice, to have a double mastectomy. And then in 2006, I had an oophorectomy. I had a hysterectomy just out of an emergency situation when I had my son, but I would have had my uterus removed also. And for me, I thought the choice was very simple. I had watched both my mother and my sister die really horrible deaths from cancer, and I really did not feel like there was any other option. And the one thing I don't hear people talk about very much is aside from reducing my risk, I really feel so much safer. Like, just the peace of mind that I have after having watched the two of them die, I really felt like I was being hunted by cancer. And since I had the surgeries, I feel safer. I feel, you know, I don't feel so scared every day. I don't think every pain is cancer. I'm really grateful I had the surgery, and I honestly don't even think it's anybody else's business. It was a hard surgery. Both the surgeries were tough, but it was my choice to make. And so I don't understand the weighing in of everybody else. It's a personal decision, and I think it should be left that way.
Thank you so much for the call, Jennifer. I was watching you react, Joanne. And number one, to when she said it's nobody else's business, and number two, the issue of peace of mind. Could you address those 2 points?
It certainly is not anyone else's business. But, you know, of course, as you do talk with family and friends about the decision you're going to make, you can't really keep that a secret for very long. But you will, unfortunately, get the opinions of others no matter what. You just kind of have to roll with it. Peace of mind, absolutely. I think for me, I just wondered, when is my day? When am I going to be told, you know, you have cancer? And when I first saw a genetic counselor years and years ago, I just didn't want to know. I didn't want to know, well, I'm going to get cancer. I just kind of, I just didn't want to deal with it. But it is definitely a peace of mind for me. It doesn't consume my thoughts every day anymore, or every 6 months when you'd go see your GYN for your checkups. You know, the risk is still there. It does not take it away 100%, but it certainly takes away that looming pressure, that cloud that just kind of hangs over you, wondering, when is my day going to come? So that is nice.
Do you have siblings, female siblings?
I have one brother.
No sisters?
No sisters, you know, but my brother has a 50% chance of having it as well. Mm-hmm. And I think for men, including my two sons, who are now 15 and almost 8, you know, they both could carry this mutation, or neither of them could carry this mutation. But I think for men in general, they also need to be paid attention to, because they could have daughters of their own who then could be in the same position that I am. So it's important for men to be focused on as well.
It's, Suzanne, interestingly, I saw a piece in the paper the other day about an increasing number of men who are having prostate surgery, for the very same reason that we're talking about here.
That'll be the newest fallout from this. Men have about an 8% risk, up to an 8% risk of developing breast cancer if they're BRCA positive. And we have a serious conversation with men about breast self-exam, and if they really have a lot of breast tissue, we talk to them about mammography, which is a very uncomfortable discussion to have. The risk of prostate cancer is increased. How much it's increased, no one really knows. It's probably at least 2 times over the general population, maybe more. But having a radical prostatectomy is a very, very big surgery for not as much risk. It's much different than having a mastectomy for a 90% lifetime risk.
We have an email here from Jackie. I have a strong family history of breast cancer. I recently had genetic testing done through 23andMe. That's a website. But they only tested the most common markers of BRCA1 and 2, a test for 3 markers. I was negative for those, but should I get full testing done? How many BRCA 1 and 2 markers are there?
You had the 3 founder markers that are associated with people of Ashkenazi Jewish ancestry, although we certainly see them in people of other ancestry. That is in no way near complete genetic testing. And I would encourage people who want to do genetic testing to not do it through a website, but to see a credentialed counselor so they can get the correct test ordered. It doesn't do any good to do genetic testing unless you have complete and comprehensive testing done.
Our time is beginning to get away. One thing I did want to get to, well, let me take a call from Fran very quickly first, and then we'll wrap it up. Fran, go ahead. You're on the air.
I thought I heard the geneticist say that if one weren't going to do the surgery, then there's no point to testing if you feel you might have a genetic risk. She would just monitor it. How would you get the insurance to pay for the monitoring at younger ages if you didn't have the genetic testing to know that you had a significant risk? And what kind of testing to monitor is she talking about? Only mammograms are ultrasound or MRIs?
Part of what I do, a big piece of the first thing I do, is I assess someone's risk for developing breast cancer. There are mathematical models we can calculate. When someone approaches the 20% risk, we change We can sometimes offer breast MRI. The decision of when to start screening is based on the family history and the youngest person diagnosed in the family. So it's very individualized. At the end of that assessment, I write a letter to the patient saying why we recommend it, and it is generally covered if it's appropriate.
Very, very quickly, as time begins to get away, the whole issue of reconstructive surgery, that's part of the discussion. What can you tell us about that and what's involved?
It is a labor-intensive process. It is not exactly what the woman had before the surgery, but I think Joanne should talk about that a little bit more.
Go ahead, Joanne.
There's various choices for reconstruction. For me, the best choice for myself, not necessarily for everyone else, is tissue expanders to help stretch the muscle, and then I had implants put in a few months later. It is not a one-step process after the first mastectomy surgery. It can be up to a year of various procedures that you have to do before you can feel kind of back to normal, I guess you could say.
Women generally feel that it's an acceptable kind of replacement.
Yeah, it's certainly not perfect. My plastic surgeon, one of the nurses said that she thinks people like us are, one of the nurses in the office said, I find people like you to be a little picky, and she did not say that in a negative way. Uh-huh. But you do. We want all those little things to look perfect because we don't look perfect anymore. So it is. It's a rather, like Dr. Mahon said, is a very labor-intensive procedure process.
We're going to have to leave it at that. I want to thank you so much, Joanne Kelly, for being with us, and continued success to you as you go through this
thank
process
you.
And live a long, happy life
yes.
with those great kids, I'm sure. Thank you. Dr. Suzanne Mahon, thank you very much, both from St. Louis University Hospital. Coming up, if your child's an athlete, is everything that can be done being done to ensure their safety on the playing field? We'll talk about that in a moment on St. Louis on the Air. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU.